Welcome to the Sports Law Biz Podcast, dedicated to helping people better understand the law and business of sports. I'm your host, Peter Ott, and we've got a lot to talk about here today, so why don't we just jump in? Hello, this is Peter Ott with the Sports Law Biz Podcast. I'm here today with Bernadette McGlade, Commissioner of the Atlantic 10 Conference. It's great to have you here with us today, Ms. McGlade.
Well, thank you. I'm happy to be here. Looking forward to our conversation.
Okay, me too. To start off, just so people can better get to know you, can you introduce yourself, give us a little bit of your history, your career path, things like that?
Absolutely. I'm here, Commissioner of the Atlantic 10 Conference. This is my eighth year being in this role. Prior to stepping in with the Atlantic 10, I spent 11 years as a Senior Associate Commissioner with the Atlantic Coast Conference in Greensboro, North Carolina. And prior to that, I was 17 years at Georgia Tech down in Atlanta, Georgia. I was hired in 1981 directly out of graduate school to be the head women's basketball coach. And then I moved into administration in the late 80s and worked at Georgia Tech throughout the course of the 90s during the Olympic Games, and then eventually made the move to the Atlantic Coast Conference. So I am a former student athlete and a former coach, and essentially my whole career has been in intercollegiate athletics.
Okay, yeah, and that's it's great that you've had different experiences both with an individual school and then also as a commissioner of a conference. I'm sure that gives you different perspectives, and that's what we're going to be talking about today. So I'd like to talk about what it means to run a collegiate conference. We hear about these things all the time, you know, the SEC, the ACC, the Pac-12. You know, you're the commissioner of the Atlantic 10 Conference. Can you tell us a little bit about this conference, where it is, how many schools there are, things like that?
Sure. We are a 14-member institution. Overall, there's 32 Division I conferences. You just named a few of them, and the Atlantic 10 is one of the 32. We are located in the state of Virginia. We also have schools here in the state of Virginia. VCU, Richmond, George Mason are all located in this state. Our footprint is as far south as North Carolina. Davidson College is one of our newest members. We go as far north as Buffalo, New York, St. Bonaventure, and as far west as St. Louis. St. Louis is one of our members. So our footprint is very concentrated. We actually cover almost 30% of the media markets in the country. And that's important because our institutions recruit nationally, not only for their intercollegiate athletic programs, but for their undergraduate students. And the ability for us to have a presence in that much of the country, and we try to leverage that to a great degree with our media contracts and exposures for not only our teams, but also for some of the other events that we participate in. So we're a rather large conference. We do not sponsor football, so that differentiates us somewhat. We are what we have coined the a basketball-centric conference, in that men's and women's basketball are our flagship sports. But we also have many, many other sports. We sponsor championships for 21 different sports throughout the course of the year. And our first championship, which is cross-country, is just around the corner in a few weeks. So, you know, we also oversee all of the governance, the NCAA compliance. We do a lot of external branding, communications, and then championships, and building our schedules is probably one of our most important and also fun things that we do, because we get to interact with so many student athletes, coaches, and campus personnel.
Okay. Yeah, no, that's a lot of stuff that the conference has to do. And that's an interesting thing, I think. A lot of people don't understand the structure of college sports, how it works. I think we're all familiar with the NCAA. We know there's the individual athletic conferences. There's the individual schools. And could you just explain a bit what the different roles and responsibilities are of, say, the NCAA, an individual conference, and then an individual school?
Absolutely. Well, I'm going to go backwards. The individual schools, as you know, are their own entities, and there's many. There's publics, there's privates, there's land-grant institutions. There are, at Division I alone, there's approximately 364 Division I institutions, and then there's also, that's at Division I, and then there's Division II and Division III institutions, and every one of those Division I institutions, for the most part, belong to a conference. So of the 64, 65 institutions, now there are a handful of Division I that are still trying to get accepted into conferences, but 98% of those 364 institutions all belong to one of the 32 conferences. And then all of the 32 Division I conferences, we all are volunteer members with the NCAA. So the NCAA is the overarching umbrella, but they also oversee and provide services and championships for not only Division I, but Division II and III. So their total institutions that the NCAA touches far exceed 1,000 institutions across the country.
Okay, and each individual conference seems to have a bit of autonomy. You know, for example, your conference doesn't have football. That's not like the NCAA says, you know, you have to have these certain sports or something like that. Certainly there are strictures, but then you can kind of control what makes your conference a little different.
Yeah, you're exactly right. Each individual conference does have autonomy on its own. We all have to meet minimum standards. Institutions have to have a minimum of 14 men's and women's sports. And then as a conference, you have to have a minimum number of members to be able to be qualified as Division I. But within those minimums, the NCAA doesn't dictate that everybody has to have every sport. So there is, you know, a lot of individual decision-making and autonomy within the structure of the NCAA.
Okay, and you already talked about some of the things that the conference does. You do scheduling and you organize these championships and things like that. How many people does that take, for example, in your conference?
Well, in the Atlantic 10, we have 12 full-time employees. We call them FTEs. And then we have two interns that basically have one-year appointments. And then we sometimes bring in some outside help for specific projects. But essentially, our staff runs anywhere from 12 to 13 employees.
Okay, and is that a common size across Division I athletics?
It's not. It really is based on how large your conference is and how many sports you sponsor. For instance, the 10 conferences that sponsor football, obviously they have larger staffs. They could have staffs as large as anywhere between 40 and 50 employees, and some of them are a little bit lower, between 25 and 30. Conferences like the Atlantic 10 that essentially are basketball-centric, we run employees somewhere between 10 and 15. And then some of the other conferences that have smaller a scope of programs, they usually have employees anywhere between, say, 7 and 10.
Okay, so it can differ in size depending on the needs of the conference. And I imagine that's similar as far as individual schools as well. You've had some experience there. I don't know. Do you know what the typical size of an athletic department is at a university? Does it just vary a lot?
Yeah, individual Division I schools, as far as how large they are staff-wise, varies. Back in 2007, when I left Georgia Tech, there were about 119 employees, and I'm sure now, almost 9 years later, I'm sure that number has risen. But then there's also Division I institutions with smaller programs that don't sponsor football, and their employees probably hover around 65. So it's varying sizes across the landscape of Division I.
Okay, and it's the same kind of thing, depending on the needs. Football tends to take a lot of staff, it sounds like, so each school can be quite different.
You're correct in that, yeah, and football is, as you know, there's the Division I BCS level where they have 85 scholarships, so their squads are in excess of 100. And then there's the FCS, and they have a lower number of scholarships, I believe 60, 65. So they're somewhere in between.
Okay. Well, great. Yeah, I think that's useful to help us understand a little better how college athletics works on the different levels. If we can move to a different subject. Lately, we've been hearing about a lot of big changes in college sports, and so I'd like to take a little bit of time to talk about that. One thing we hear a lot about is conference realignment. Schools are changing their affiliation with conferences. You know, for example, your conference is named the Atlantic 10, and there's 14 members. I imagine that's a product of that. How does that affect your conference? How do you think that affects all of college sports?
Well, the last 3 years have been pretty significant as far as conference realignment has been concerned. We've seen a total shift in Division I membership. As a matter of fact, every conference, with the exception of the Ivy League, has been touched by conference realignment. So essentially 31 conferences have all experienced some type of change in membership. And that's a significant shift. So it really has been kind of an historic 3-year period. You know, any time that the membership of a Division I conference changed, there's a lot that goes with that, not only just the transition of a member potentially leaving or a new member coming in, but there's almost an entire restructuring of your championship model, your regular season playing schedule, and of course, your financial model and the way your revenue is generated and distributed to be able to sustain all of the championships and all of the support you're providing. So it's been a pretty momentous three-year period. I will admit the last, I would say, 9 months been relatively quiet across the country, which is, in my opinion, a good thing. And it seems like conferences and member institutions have somewhat settled into their new environment.
Okay, so it looks like it's settled down a little bit, but, you know, schools changing affiliations and things like that is more work for the conferences to do, right? You have to fix the schedules and championships and things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And as you know, conferences begin to create their own identity and their own affinity with their fans. And when there's a change in membership, I won't say the whole apple cart gets upset, but there are a lot of transitional and a lot of new decisions that have to be made. And everyone is affected. Your student athletes are affected, your coaches are affected, your administration's affected, and you have to retool and almost in many cases continue to reinvent yourself so that everyone understands, you know, their role within your league.
Okay. So yeah, lots of big effects and changes there. We'll see how that pans out in the future. Moving on to another topic. Another issue you hear a lot about is the issue of compensating college athletes in some way. There's been a lot of discussion about this. I remember you came to speak about it at a UVA law symposium while I was attending school there. And, you know, I'm sure you're familiar with all these lawsuits. Just yesterday, as of recording this, we had the O'Bannon lawsuit. The Ninth Circuit ruled on that. So I guess my question is, how would a move to compensate college athletes affect the Atlantic 10 Conference?
Well, I think the ruling that basically came down yesterday from the Ninth Circuit Court was a really positive ruling because it essentially said that Judge Wilkins' decision to say that $5,000 should be put in a trust fund to be paid to student athletes, they essentially struck that down as erroneous. And they reaffirmed the fact that not paying student athlete reaffirms the amateur status. And I am in full agreement with that. I think it was the right ruling yesterday. However, you know, the ruling also included a caveat that the NCAA in previous history prevented student athletes from receiving full cost of attendance and that they believe that that was a violation of antitrust. So I think it was a little bit of a mixed decision, but at the end of the day, I think overall it was very positive and it was a win-win for member institutions and student athletes.
Right. Yeah, it was a decision that seemed to it sounds like you're generally pretty happy with it, but just in my reading on the internet and things like that, it seems like a lot of people on both sides are a bit unhappy because it reaffirmed the amateur status of college athletes, but it opened up this idea of paying them more or compensating them through cost of attendance, which is something a lot of schools already wanted to do. So I sounds like you're comfortable with that notion and maintaining the amateur status of college athletes.
Yeah, absolutely, because cost of attendance still falls under the umbrella of educational expenses and an educational scholarship. So it's not pay to student athletes. They're not going to be taxed on that money or have to pay taxes on those dollars because they are educational designated funds. And again, I'm a strong proponent that if the pendulum were to move in another direction at a future time, more towards paying student athletes an actual wage, it will totally change the landscape for intercollegiate athletics. And in many respects, if you calculated the value of the scholarship right now, whether it's an institution like University of Virginia or in one of my institutions like George Washington University, when a one-year scholarship is calculated, the value, hard dollars, is in excess of $65,000 a year. As you and I know, that's a pretty handsome base salary if you were
right
to receive that. And again, I think it would totally change the scope of what we do in intercollegiate athletics if all of a sudden a pay-for-play model were to be adopted.
Okay. Well, yeah, the O'Bannon decision seems to have perhaps reached an ending point. We'll see if it gets appealed. And then there's a lot of others going on right now, a lot of other lawsuits. So I'm sure this will be an issue of discussion for the future, for sure.
Yeah, I agree with you. And as you know, it seems like, you know, and you're in law school, right? So you're in this track for life. But it seems that all the litigation just continues to occur. And I guess that's just the culture that we're living in right now.
Okay, well, thanks for sharing your thoughts on that and taking time out of your day to record this podcast. I think it's been very interesting, and I'm sure my listeners have as well.
I really enjoyed visiting with you.
Okay, yeah, no, thanks for coming. Is there anything else you want to say before we wrap this up?
No, for everyone listening to the podcast, go out and go see an A-10 school compete in men's or women's basketball or any other sport.
Yeah, no, there's some good schools in there for sure. So yeah, thanks for coming on and taking the time to speak with us. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
This has been an episode of the Sports Law Biz podcast. This podcast is available through the Sports Law Biz website or through iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and YouTube. Before wrapping things up, I'd like to thank some people. First of all, I'd like to thank my friend Lieb Montoya for designing the Sports Law Biz podcast logo as well as the Sports Law Biz blog logo. His artistic ability certainly surpasses mine. If interested, you can check out more of Lieb's work on Instagram and Twitter. His handle is @LiebMontoya in both places. That's @LIBMontoya. Additionally, I'd like to thank the musical artist for providing this theme music that you're listening to right now. The artist is a band called The Losers. The album is entitled Young, Tough, Terrible. The track is Sports with an exclamation point. The label is Needle Drop Co. This music is available through a Creative Commons license of Attribution Non-Commercial 3.0 Unported. This podcast was produced and recorded by myself, Peter Ott. And you can reach me at my personal Twitter handle, @PeterJOTT, through the Sports Law Biz Twitter handle, @SportsLawBiz, or through email at sportslawbizblog@gmail.com. Any feedback is greatly appreciated. If you are interested in contributing to either the Sports Law Biz blog or podcast, definitely reach out to me. I love to talk to people about these issues, and I know I can use all the help I can get. Finally, I'd like to thank you for listening to this podcast. Hopefully it was enjoyable. If so, please spread the word and let your friends and colleagues know about it. Leave a review on iTunes. Any way you can spread the news about this podcast would be greatly appreciated. That's our episode today. Tune in next time to learn more about the law and business of sports. I'm looking forward to discussing it with you on the Sports Law Biz podcast.